Test, test, testing, 1, 2, 1, 2. My name is Nancy Nuss. I work with the Florida Folk Life Programs in White Springs. Today I'm at the home of Dr. Bob Engel.
This is Nancy Nuss.
In Apalachicola at 173 Avenue B Street. And he's going to talk with me about
the
history of ethnic groups and fishing traditions here in Apalachicola.
173 Avenue B in Apalachicola.
Well, this town has had massive influx, relatively, considering the size of it.
Talking about
from
maritime history
Europe.
Here in this particular town.
First of all, during the terrible periods in Ireland, actually before the Civil War here, the Irish came over from escaping political turmoil and hunger and all. And then there were, later, after the Civil War, there was an influx of Italians, and a little later the Greeks came in. Now, I'm not sure what role the Irish played in the fishing industry, but they were here during the cotton boom, and this was one of the major ports of the Gulf of Mexico. Of course, it lost that when the railroad ran from Columbus, Georgia, I think, maybe Bainbridge, over to Savannah, and that took that trade away. But then later, the lumber boom came along, and there was a lot of work here for everybody. And that went on up to, actually, in an attenuated form until right now. And it's still very small, but it's still here. But the Italians and the Greeks who came in as fishermen. And most of the Greeks came from one tiny town, and I don't remember the name of it, but some of the descendants of the early settlers here will know all about it. In fact, there's a local doctor here who goes back every few years to renew his background. Now, the Greeks have been very possessive of their heritage, and they always speak Greek in the home up until there may be a few families today that have given up on it. But I know some fourth-generation young people here who are very fluent in Greek, because it's spoken in the home, and they have a tendency to marry within their nationality, reaching out beyond these city limits and county limits and going as far as back to Greece for brides. Some of them marry Greeks from Florida and Greeks from Alabama and so forth, but once in a while you'll find one that breaks ranks, but basically they are maintaining the language and the purity of their nationality. I think that's basically true in any place that I've run into the Greeks, including Tarpon Springs, where it's practically an enclave of Greek culture. Now, the Italians and Greeks came in as fishermen. Basically, that's what they were doing in the old country, and they were very good at it. The Greeks became sponge fishermen, and they lined themselves up along the coast here. We had a sponge exchange here. The building is still standing downtown. It's brick, masonry, very solidly built. Someday I hope that it'll be restored and made into a some sort of a place where people can visit.
Does that have any marker on it?
I don't know.
I
don't know, but it's down there.
And do you know about what period we're talking about? That the
be around the turn of the century. By the way, there's a lady here in town that I consider the foremost historian for this area, and you'd be well advised to go talk to her, and you may want to set aside a good bit of time for her. That's Margaret Key.
I've spoken with her a little bit.
Well, she lives right over here. in a picturesque Queen Anne house. I rented from her. She was working in Tallahassee when I first came here, and I lived in that house, and it's a beauty. Circular staircase and the whole works. Anyway, she will know a lot of things that I don't know, and I think probably where fishing is concerned, I could be ahead of her because that's my interest. But the sponge fishermen worked, some of the best beds were over here out of St. Mark's, Florida, and that St. Mark's sponge was highly esteemed. And they were in and out of Tarpon Springs and all the way down to the Florida Keys, and we still have a small sponge fishery down there. The one in Tarpon Springs is, if it exists at all today, I guess it does. It's mainly tourist-oriented, and it's not the viable industry that you would describe as an industry. But through the years, it became obvious that they needed one center for the sponges to be sold and bartered. And Tarpon Springs turned out to be it because it was, for several reasons, it was midpoint between Apalachicola and the Keys or thereabouts, and it was next to a large amount of sponges, and they still do a little buying and selling in the Keys, I think, but not as very small. But at one time, the Tarpon Springs Sponge Exchange was a very vigorous, profitable enterprise. All the boats would bring their catches in there, and they'd have auctions and so forth. Now, from that, the Greeks who settled here and didn't move down there, they became basically deep water fishermen. Now, that may be due to the fact that they had, by heritage, been deep water fishermen for sponges. And I knew some of the old men that had been at it. They couldn't speak any English at all. They'd been at it for many, many years out of here. And their sons were working on the boats with them for a long time, going out catching snappers and groupers and so forth on the reefs out here. Hard-working, pleasant people. I enjoyed the ones I knew, and of course their descendants, two and three generations later, are still here, and they're friends of mine. They maintained their food, the dishes that they esteemed in Greece were produced here, and there's such things as feta cheese was sold, and you can still buy that here in town. And they basically maintained their culture better than any of the rest of them did. The Italians were more inshore fishermen and used nets, gill nets and seines and so forth. And they brought along a tradition of fishing for sturgeon. Now, I don't know, there probably were some Greek sturgeon fishermen. I don't, before I ever got here, but by the time I got here, it was primarily Italians. The main one that I knew was Sicilian. There's a lot of Sicilians here, descended from Sicilian stock. In fact, the Florida fishing and shrimp fishing industry of southeastern United States at one time had a great many Sicilians, and some of the leaders in the industry, Versaghi's, were from not far from Syracuse in Sicily. They live in St. Augustine, which is another cultural enclave. They still have a lot of that. The early days of the shrimp industry, you know, took place. They were shrimping with seines, and this is all in a little publication I have around here somewhere. And one of the Versaghis and the Salvadors were the first to use motors pulling trawls. This was a great innovation. They did that over on St. Augustine and Fernandina. Now, here's another little aside that you might find interesting, is the fact that these names of these people got badly mangled early in the game. And when they came in, they were, of course, illiterate as well as not English-speaking. And, of course, everybody was in a hurry, and there were great numbers of them. And the Salvador brothers... I'm personally acquainted with all these people, so I've gone into this. Johnny Salvador, who died two or three years ago, and his brother Felix, told me that when their father came in this country, his name was Salvador something. I don't know what they told me. And in the process of getting into the country, the names got changed around. The first name became the last name. And the feeling they all tell me was they were in here and they didn't give a damn what their name was. They were not going to make any noise. So Johnny Salvador and Felix Salvador took the name his father had when he entered the country. And they're... couple of families around here who have told me about the early name thing. One of the Greeks was a boat builder who came here. Of course, ignorant, illiterate, but very skilled as a boat builder. And he had one of these impossible Greek names, the great long series of syllables and all. And the man at the store, he'd go up and charge stuff at the ship chandlers. And the man at the store said, "I'm not going to write this out. Your name is George." Well, I mustn't say that because I promised I would not say that. Anyway, he gave him a name. And that became the surname of that family. And there, a lot of them still here. And there are other changes deliberate. The names were so impossible and they had so much trouble with it that they shortened it in some cases and changed it a little bit to make it more pronounceable to the Americans and so forth. So,
what type of boat did he build?
I don't know. There's a man here in town that might know, if you can find him. His name is George Demo George. Sailing vessel, I'm satisfied, because they didn't have motors in the vessels around here until late in the game. Most of the people that I knew when I first came here had remembered using them the first time. There was an old one called a Lathrop. Was the first popular one here, inboard. And I think it was probably one cylinder, I don't know. Something like our present Wisconsin air-cooled engines, I don't know. This is something that there are plenty of older people around here, say, my age and older, who would remember all this. I don't. It was all over by the time I got here. So, the the Greeks never attended the Catholic Church. They preferred to attend the Episcopal Church, if they went to church, and they had their rituals and their services in that church on loan from the Episcopalians. Lathrop, it was a gasoline engine. It was the first one that most of these people ever used. Oh, an interesting thing. I was in Turkey working for a while, and I'm a dilettante student of history and archaeology and so forth, and I knew about these boats that the Greeks had on their vases and urns going back to Mycenaean days, in fact. And when I got to Turkey, there they were, still in use. And the same boat, you can still find them in Tarpon Springs, built by the Greeks in the old method and the old style with the high freeboard and all that, that were popular in the days of that the Mycenaeans were. Now, I'm speculating on the boats in Mycenae. I don't think I can do that. I don't believe they've got that established. But certainly early in Greek history, that style was very common. And there's one that was working out, had been somewhat altered, but it was working out of Caribel. A man bought it down Tarpon Spring and brought it up here and put it in shape to use as a snapper and grouper fishing boat. But now, this part of the Greek culture was brought over here and established here and was used here, just exactly like the ancients did it.
Are there any Greeks in the area still building boats?
Not here.
Are there any of them that are still fishing?
I don't think so. There were several when I came here in 49. One of the best known was named George Mosconis. He couldn't speak English. As far as I know, he couldn't. He never did with me. And he had some sons. One of them just died here about 6 months ago. But there's one of them, let's see now. I don't know if any of his sons are still alive or not, but his grandsons are here. One of them's on the county commission, chairman. And these Greeks are sufficiently interested in their family history and in their lore and all that a lot of these people would be worth your talking to, I would think. But George Mosconis, the old man, he was old when I got here in 49. He was one of the most liked, loved men I've ever known. Everybody in this whole community loved George Mosconis. Jolly. And he was excellent at what he did. Without any of these scientific guiding navigation instruments or anything, he knew exactly where he was every minute out there, and he would... They had a lead line, a piece of lead that was hollow, and they'd put soap in the end of it. And they would cast that over the side, and it would bring up fragments of the bottom. Well, that bottom doesn't change, by my own understanding of it. It doesn't change very much for miles out there. It's pretty much the same, but of course it has minor variations. And along with his estimation of the height of the sun and whatever else he was going by, and the running time and speed and all, he'd throw that thing over and he knew exactly where he was. The people were marveled at this out here. So,
would that soap pick up
the pieces of the bottom. Now, I was going to talk about the sturgeon fishermen, and they had a nice tradition that they, I presume, brought straight from Europe of drift nets that would entangle these fish. Of course, the fish get to be huge, 6.5 feet, and... They knew the season of the year, spring, the fish were heading upstream to spawn. And when they built that dam at Chattahoochee, that interfered with it a good bit, and they still catch them around here, but I suspect the population is very low compared to what it was. They'd bring them in, and then there was a Sicilian named Joe Taranto, whose son is still in the same building down there, who knew all about making caviar. So he would be hanging in cheesecloth, I guess. Mosquito. What's this real flimsy stuff, I think made out of cotton with big, fairly big mesh, like a cheesecloth? Okay. Well, they'd mix it all up with lots and lots of salt. Lots of salt. And they'd put it in that cheesecloth and hang it up. And it'd hang there for days, dripping. And when it was time, they'd take it down. And I always got some of them. It was tremendous. I've eaten beluga in Iran. I worked in Iran for a while. And I've eaten that, supposed to be the best in the world, but it wasn't a damn bit better than what we had here. Well, now, that was a cultural activity, in my opinion, that was brought over here, has since died out. They don't, these nationalities get entrained in the American way of life, and they don't go in for this anymore. There was one little old man, he must have been 100 years old, still going out. We called him Poopy. I don't remember what his name was, if I ever knew, but nobody knew him by anything but that. Always smoked a corncob pipe, and he'd down there, little fella, mending his nets all the time and going out. And there were some other Italians who were catching sturgeon.
And Poopy was an Italian?
Yes. Poopy was a Sicilian, I think. He was a friend of Joe Taranto's, and they were... I have never gone into the origins of some of these folks around here. Now there's an old woman, Martina, who married the son of a man who came over here from Italy, and she would possibly know where they came from. But the Martina genes are all over this town. The name itself is everywhere. And then the girls, of course, married, and they're here and producing children. And I would say that old boy from Italy who came in here and he served as a kind of a blacksmith probably has more genes going for him in this community than any two or three other people combined.
Is her name?
You said her name is Martina.
Do you know her first name?
No. The girl, one of her daughters works in the post office. Her name is Gloria. But she goes by the name of Mahan. She married a descendant of one of the Irish families here. And that would be your best contact, to arrange to talk to the old lady, because she lives with her. Mahan's husband died, and in fact, they were only married a short while, and she never remarried, and she lives with her mother, and her mother is very, very old. I don't know, she might be 90 or something like that. So,
now you said that he came in and worked as a blacksmith?
I guess, among other things, kind of fixed things, and I had a little forge, so I was told, by his grandson, who worked for me for many years. He died here about 6 months ago, Buddy Martina. It's a big family. And now, one of the impacts of this influx of Italians and Irish was that they brought Catholicism into this community. As you know, I'm sure, H.L. Mencken described this solid South as a Bible Belt. The fundamentalist Baptist religion is everywhere, and piney wood sects and other Protestant denominations, and it has controlled the whole situation except right here. And we had two Catholic churches. This is a town of 3,500 people. Two Catholic churches and two convents and two schools, parochial schools, at one time here. Now, that was all pretty well. One of the schools had quit by the time I got here. For the whites. They had some for the blacks up on the hill. Now, I don't know the remnants of that. There are still two white nuns here. And they work up there on the hill. And I think they teach. I'm not certain about that.
But where's the hill?
The hill is where the blacks live. It's up the other side of the main drag here. So you still have, although religion is not as commanding anywhere as it once was, you still have here this tremendous Catholic population. And that brought on one of the big anomalies that it created was booze. They're tolerant of this, and all this country was dry. Some of it still is. I don't think you can buy any liquor at all in Wakulla County. I think they may have voted it in. I don't know, about a year or two ago. But up north of here, you still can't buy it. But at one time, it was all dry, even Tallahassee. Of course, it was the wettest dry town in the world, but they still couldn't sell it up there. And in my book, I say that I don't agree with H.L. Mencken. I'd rather call it the grease girdle, because everything in the South is cooked in grease. Everything. Vegetables, nice ribeye steaks, whatever it is, throw it in that hot fat. And I continually complain about this, and I compare when I travel around the capital of Chad, a place called N'Djamena, which is part of the old French Empire, constantly at war now with Libya, trying to invade from the north, and the French trying to help them. But that town, formerly called Fort LeMay, was a town of about 250,000 people, I guess. Kind of a broken-down place, but fine restaurants, as good as you'll find anywhere in the world. The cuisine of Vietnamese, they had Algerian cuisine, they had French cuisine, and all of the different areas that France had previously had in the empire were represented there in restaurants. Now, I point that out in my book as indicative of something, because you don't have any good restaurants today in Tallahassee. Not one that I know of. Well, the man was killed yesterday that owned the best one, the Flamingo. He was written up by Ashby Stiff in his weekly Thursday column, where he goes to reports on a different restaurant every time. That restaurant is reported upon today in the same issue of the paper. The man that owned it died, and he had a $45,000 car. I've forgotten what it was, a Mercedes or some fancy foreign car, and it went out of control and he killed him. That's not part of this cultural thing here, I'm afraid. But, anyway.
Give me a little of your background, of where you're from and how you got to Apalachicola. We haven't done that on tape yet.
Well, I was trained as a teacher at the University of Illinois. I grew up and born and raised in Danville, Illinois, 32 miles away. And I taught and coached a swimming team in Rochester, Minnesota for 2 years. Went into the Navy, and they picked, I think it was about 25 of us out of the Navy, out of their resources, that had degrees in biology and wanted to take the training, they sent me to medical school, and I took work in tropical diseases. And I ended up teaching some of it before I left there, some of the parasitology theory and all. And then they sent me to Trinidad, and as a man about 25 or 6 years old, I had the entire Lesser Antilles in that part of the Caribbean Sea frontier for malaria control. Census of diseases and some research, which was a big move, I thought. And I was down there about 3 years and traveled all through that area as part of my job. And then I went back to graduate school, University of Illinois, and I had gotten involved with saltwater biology down there. I had these nice laboratories and all the equipment, so I decided I'd find out more about the sea because I had never had any real coursework in it or anything. And I found it to be extremely interesting. I made plankton nets out of ladies' old tossed-away nylon stockings and all that. But I had fine equipment, laboratory equipment, microscopes and everything. And I decided that I would go down to the University of Miami and take some work in that to see what it was all about. They had a little tiny fledgling marine lab down there, which today is the size at least of Bowdoin College or Wabash College or some of these universities. It's out on Virginia Key, and it's a great many great big buildings and everything. But at that time, it was in a two rooms, which to get...